Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
If I can say one thing about this man who I'm about to talk to is he has a pair of balls, and there's no doubt about that, and no one can deny him them. He's probably one of our most famous Irish trade union officials. He led the ILDA, Irish Locomotive Drivers Association, for many years, and he was the former secretary of the ESB Group of Unions. I think many of you will know who he is. He's now an independent candidate for the Dublin constituency at this forthcoming European Parliament election. Brendan Ogle, it's good to talk to you, Brendan. Good evening.
Good evening, Gareth. How are you?
Very good. I hope the balls are in good shape and that they're ready.
I checked them out before I come on, Gareth. They're still there anyway.
I check mine out every commercial break. Anyway, let's get down to business, Brendan. You've been through a very rough time lately. I know that you were diagnosed with throat cancer some years back. Isn't that the case?
That's right, Gareth, yeah. I suppose it's a bit late at night for a tale of woe for your listeners. But
No, it's not, sure. Because we love it. And we empathise with it, because I think one of the things I love to encourage this time of the night is human interest. And I think it's something that we all dwell on, our own problems, our own issues, things that we're connected to through family members and friends. So please don't think it's a woe issue at all.
Okay, well, I'll bear my soul a small bit, Gareth, then. Before COVID in 2021, the year before that, actually, in 2020, my dear sister Breach was like a mother to me. She was diagnosed with brain cancer, and she lived in Dundalk, and she came to stay with a few swords and did her treatment in the Beaumont, and she passed away. It was very, very aggressive. She passed away in February 2021, just before COVID came. And then my mum died of COVID then in March. We think my mum might have been the fifth, there or thereabouts, person in Ireland to die of COVID. And then just over a year later, I took my sister to the Beaumont. She came here to stay with us in Swords during her treatment, and I took her most days. I got to know the people in the radiology department in St. Luke's in Beaumont. And little did I know that a year later, I developed COVID myself. It was the D variant, very aggressive as well. And it was before vaccination. But anyway, a few weeks, I got over that. And I had swellings in my glands, as you do with a bad infection. And over a couple of months later, the swellings on my right side of my throat and neck went down, but not on my left. So we were in lockdown at the time, and I was in town working, and a friend of mine was actually up from the country for something, and we met for one of those outdoor cups of coffee, and she actually asked me what was the swelling, and I knew her sister had passed away. So I just said, it's COVID. She says, that's not COVID. So I was in my GP that afternoon, in Drumcondra there, the fantastic Dr. Ecky. Mm-hmm. And he had me in the Beaumont very, very quickly. And yeah, indeed, I was diagnosed with throat cancer. There were two tumours, so I had some surgery. And then I had... They actually, and this will come as a surprise to you, Garrett, who knew me once upon a time. They found that apart from the cancer, I was a very healthy specimen.
Right.
So they threw the most and the strongest chemotherapy and radiation and the maximum number of doses they could at me. And that was very, it was a journey, I can tell you that. And luckily I was one of the people, you go in there every day. People, I know a lot of people have been through it. A lot of people have helped family through it. And it really is a lottery. Cancer, it has no class, it has no gender, it has no sexuality, it has no colour. It's completely random who gets it, and it's completely random who survives it. And I know that from myself and from family and from people I sat with, people who got it before me, people who got it after me, people we shared coffee and tea with waiting for their treatment. And luckily, about a year later, I had to do another PET scan, and they found that the treatment had worked, and so that's almost 2 years now, and not quite, but I'm I've lost a third of my body weight, so I'm a slimmed down version of my former self, and I kind of like that. I lost 4.5 stone in weight, and I think I put about 2 back on.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of happy with that at the moment.
You're a healthy weight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I look all right, Gareth, now. I kind of, you know, I look younger, maybe.
Yeah.
Some of the photographs that are going around the last week now, kind of, yeah, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I'm looking at a photograph of you here. Now, mind you, it's a good while back. It's during the water charges, so that was pre-cancer, pre-COVID. But, yeah, kind of a John Kennedy Jr. kind of look about you. But I don't want to swell your head, obviously. Just on the cancer thing, Brendan, when someone in a senior medical position such as an oncologist turns around to you and says, yes, you have cancer, and let's face it, throat cancer is one of the most difficult to treat. What did you think of? Did you think of the possibility that you could die?
Absolutely. I didn't think of any other possibility. There wasn't a possibility to me at that point. It was a certainty, because remember what I told you about my sister. And my sister is a very much more positive person, I suppose, than I am. She literally, I loved her very much. She really was a ray of sunshine, and not just in my life, but in everybody's life. So when she was diagnosed, and as I said, she stayed with us, she was absolutely determined up until a couple of weeks before she died. She was absolutely convinced and determined that she was going to beat this thing. And I seen that and sat here with her every night watching films and having dinner with her, and I seen her positivity, and I seen then that she didn't make it. So when I was diagnosed then a year later, that was my entry point. So when the senior oncologist you're talking about, and in my case, he was an absolute gentleman, Dr. James Paul O'Neill there in the Beaumont.
Mm-hmm.
He called me in. I was, I think my appointment was about 11:15. I decided to go on my own, big mistake. And I went in at I was supposed to go in at 11:15. And then I realized that people who were turning up the appointments after me were being called before me. And then I kind of thought, well, they're kind of leaving me to the end here. That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
So I went in and he just told me straight away, in a very matter-of-fact way, you've got cancer. This is what we're going to do. This is the treatment plan. So I said, no, you're not. You're not going to do any of that. Mm. And he said, what do you mean we're not going to do any of that? So I told him about my sister, and I told him about the outcome, and I asked him. So he says, look, it's a completely different cancer. It's very aggressive, but he says, we can cure you. We can save you, but you're going to have to work with us, and you're going to do exactly what you're told. Not an easy thing for me now.
Mm.
You're going to have to do exactly what you're told.
Yeah.
So I asked him the tough question. I said, if I don't listen to you, because, look, I knew I had 2 tumours. I could see them on the chin, but I felt okay. I said to him, if I don't listen to you, what's going to happen? And he said, well, if you don't listen to me, you'll be back here in 6 months, and we'll be having a completely different conversation than the one we're having now. And I said, well, you're straight, aren't you? So that was it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got on the horse. I went. I kind of stumbled a few times. Once in particular during the treatment, and you know, but the fabulous people in the Beaumont in the radiology department, a fabulous young doctor there, Dr. Palak, got me back on the horse the day that I fell off it. And because you know they want to give you 35 sessions, there isn't room for gaps. You don't get to take a time out. You know, they're giving you 35 sessions in 7 weeks, and that's it. So I missed the day because I just hit rock bottom, really, and I kind of give up. And she rang and spoke to Mandy, my wife, and then she spoke to me and she says, well, you know, if you don't come back, what's going to happen? So, you know, yeah, I went back. She gave me 2 sessions the next day, and look it. It's a good news story, and if I was saying anything to listeners, especially male listeners, Garrett, and I've spoken about it, and I think it should be spoken about. I'm 56 years of age, you know, and I think men, you know, were inclined not to take these things seriously. Thankfully, I met that woman I know for Portlaoise, and she kind of gave me the impetus to go to the doctor. But men, if you are worried about things, you know, we don't have as many regular checks. Typically, a man doesn't have as perhaps women do. So if you don't, keep an eye on it. If you're worried about something, don't. Another couple of months would have been too late for me, So don't sit around for months waiting for it to go away. Go to a doctor, get a few blood tests, get it checked out, take it seriously. That's kind of what I'd say. And then trust the system. It might work out for you. Hopefully it would work out for people. And it doesn't work out for everybody, of course. But my experience, I have to say, was, and I'm very critical, as you know, of some of the things in this country that don't work. But in terms of the cancer treatment that I got and the people that I met, from the radiologists to the surgeons to the chemotherapists to everybody, to the receptionists, to the nurses, to the people who bring you your food, absolutely superb. I couldn't say a bad word about one of them. So trust the system and get yourself checked out.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to that actually in a few minutes in relation to your candidacy for the 2024 European Parliament election. Did it change you when you look back at the man you were before the diagnosis to what you are now? Are you different?
I'm certainly physically different, but I know that's not what you're asking me. People say and people think, when you get the good news, shall we say, that's a big day. I went to that on my own as well, actually. But when you get the good news, you're going in there and you don't really know what's going to happen. And they put you lie down in this machine and they don't tell you either. You're waiting about a week and then you go back and the Orla McCardle told me that, it's good results. So you kind of think then that you should be walking on clouds and the people around you are.
Yeah.
Your wife is and your children. I remember the day I went down to Athlone to tell my children that I had cancer. That was possibly the most difficult day of my life. And I remember the day I went down then to tell them that I got the good results from the PET scan. And that was definitely one of the best days of my life. So in that sense, you're walking. But you're waiting for a kind of a breakthrough. And I suppose reflecting on it now, I've always kind of believed that, while we're here, we should try to do some good. I've always kind of believed that anyway. I think you know that from me through the years. Might not always succeed, but I think we need to try. And I think, if anything, that resolve has strengthened because I'm very aware. I'll tell you what it does, Garrett. I'll tell you what it does. It's the best way to answer your question. Most people, and definitely me, pre-cancer, we assume we're going to live forever. Now, we all know intellectually we're not going to, but we live our lives as if we are. And then you get a cancer diagnosis. And I think from that moment on, even when you're getting good news, that switch flips. You go from assuming you're going to live forever to assuming you're going to die tomorrow. So your sense of your own mortality, and that's very acute with me, given some of the things that have gone on in my family in the last few years anyway. So your sense of your own mortality, your sense that, we're here for a short time. We only have a certain amount of time to do some good, to make a difference, to be with our families, to spend time with the people we love, to enjoy a football match or whatever. I think your sense of your own mortality changes everything.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But Darius, look, I know you as well. I know you haven't been on a dissimilar journey either, so I know what I'm talking about.
But very much.
Great to hear you so well as well, by the way.
Thank you, Brendan. Thanks. And I'm delighted that you made it back, as they say. And I'm delighted that you made it back in full health. I mean, from listening to you just now, it's almost like as if you walked out that door of the hospital and they literally said to you, right, we're going to give you back exactly as you were beforehand, there's been no knock-on effects, there's been no side effects, there's been no repercussions as such. But let's go back to what probably most people remember you for, which is someone who lived his life being as stubborn as he possibly could on behalf of other people in the sense that you were fighting for them. You were fighting for people who were afraid to stand up to the people they worked for. And that became your job, didn't it?
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that, Gareth. That's a nice thing to say. I think, since I went to England in the 1980s, and a young man in London, you know, having a good time, but working in the railway, and I found myself joining unions, and Thatcher was trying to privatise at the time, and she said, look, we were on strike every few weeks. So I got a real grounding there in something I hadn't had maybe as a child. And I came back with a very acute sense of the power of people coming together. Now, look, it wasn't great. Thatcher managed to privatise the railway and it has never been as good since. But I came back. We don't always win, Gareth, you know. I came back... And with that sense of collective and of the strength of people coming together. So, when I got involved in, and you mentioned ILDA there earlier on, that's 24 years ago now, Gareth.
It's 2000, Brendan, and I want to just talk about that.
2000
because
was the lockout, yeah.
That's right. I remember the ILDA was, that was the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association. So the train drivers in CIE, as it was at that stage, that was their union. And
a big chunk of them anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and you led the union. And at that stage, for those who don't remember, and 24 years is a long, long time, particularly when you consider how this country has changed so much in that time. We had a railway infrastructure that really, God, it was the pity of Europe in many respects. But we also had a workforce who were driving these trains, and many of them weren't fit for purpose when you think back to the 1980s and that. And it was very much a disjointed system at that stage, where it was management way out there and it was the train drivers and associated staff way out the other side. So what, just to remind everybody, what happened in the run-up to that strike that I think everybody who took trains and took public transport will always remember?
Well, you call it a strike, we call it a lockout.
A lockout, okay.
So basically, look, you're right about all the underinvestment, and the terms and conditions were terrible at the time for drivers. Basically, everybody worked a seven-day week. You had to work 7 days a week to make a decent living, and you could make a decent living, but you had to work 7 days a week to do it, and that's no life, you know?
Yeah.
And then there were a lot of train accidents happening in England. There was Paddington, there was Purley, there was Clapham Junction, there was Watford Junction, and we were aware of the underinvestment, and we were aware of the state of the track. But Irish Rail at the time, and it's not fair to single out any individual. The company at the time decided to go down a route of a productivity deal, and they wanted to introduce terms and conditions, which to us would have given us some time off, yes, but it would have created, for example, part-time train drivers, that everybody on the railway would be taught to drive a train, and if Brendan Ogle didn't come in or was on holidays or was sick, it could be put down your brush there and jump up on the train. And so we were aware of the safety issues of our job, and we were also aware and linked in to the British Train Drivers Union, ASLEF, at the time. Mm. And there were some people carrying out statutory investigations. I remember Peter Rayner carrying out a statutory investigation into the Paddington disaster, and that was a disaster.
Yeah.
And he looked at what they were proposing in Irish Rail and wrote a report, a Rayner report, and said, this is completely off the charts in safety terms. And so basically, we refused terms. The new conditions were coming in. They were agreed with the two unions at the time. I won't even mention those because it's historic now.
Mm.
They were agreed with the two unions at the time, but a big chunk of the drivers, about half, said, you know, we're not doing it. And we formed our own little breakaway union. We thought it was an easy thing to do, Gareth. Little did we know. We did it in the Ashling Hotel in Dublin, and all of a sudden RTE were outside, and there might be a strike. And I remember Paul Gates with the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, and who's going to go out and talk to them? And somebody said, you go out. So I was, big mouth from Dundalk was picked to go out and talk to the media. And that was it. Life has never been the same since.
No, it hasn't. That's for sure.
I became public enemy number one. I became the maverick. I became, sure, there wasn't the name I wasn't called.
I also remember like the likes of some of the people on Morning Ireland interviewing you. And you did, in fairness, you know, behind the scenes, you were regarded as the most formidable interviewee on any of the radio news and television news programs, because no one ever knew how
you... That was complete naivety. That's the gift of not knowing what you're doing, Gareth.
But, you know, I look at how, I mean, you know, there's great achievements in madness, in the sense that, I can't remember who it was that said it, but they said, if something doesn't work, try something else. And if that doesn't work, try anything. But whatever you do is don't allow yourself to get backed into a corner, because when you do that, the people you're representing begin to lose faith in you. And down through the years, as I sort of watched you on news programs and being interviewed on radio news shows, that was all. It seemed to me as though that was the stand you always took. I'm not going to be backed into a corner here.
Well, you know, I, at that time I was a train driver, by the way. I was a train driver in Athlone, and because I moved to Athlone because we could afford a house in Athlone. We couldn't afford a house in Dublin, so we moved to Athlone, and a lovely town, and we'd spent 10 good years there. And I was doing this out of my box room, and the internet was new. Do you remember when you used to plug in the internet? It was all like, remember all that stuff was going on? So it wasn't like it is now, you know. There was no social media and constantly in communications, and there was reams of paper coming out of fax machines, and it was. But I kind of just believed, maybe this is ridiculous, I kind of believed if you're doing the right thing for the right reasons, good things will happen.
Yeah. And
even though it's 25 years later and I'm still waiting for good things to happen, I still have that belief, Gareth, you know.
But it's a perfect lead into your latest venture, which I know you are committing yourself to 150%. And this was something I wanted to talk to you about also tonight. Like, you announced there a couple of weeks back that you've registered your candidacy for the Dublin constituency, and you're running for the European Parliament as an MEP hopeful on 7th of June. Are you mad?
Ask me on the 8th of June.
Okay. I don't mean I'm kind of partially being funny in a strange kind of way. I don't believe you are
mad. Look, Gareth, I only registered I only registered 9 days ago, and at least 9 times every day I've asked myself, am I mad, since then? And if some of the people around me are convinced I am mad.
Maybe by keeping your feet on the ground 9 times a day and asking yourself that question, you are doing the right thing. Because I think, from what I've seen, there are a lot of people in their campaigns who seem to assume that this is almost a kind of a shoe-in for them because of the associations that they keep with the support they're getting from, I suppose, mainstream. Whereas you're doing this completely on your own, aren't you?
Completely, yeah, yeah. First of all, people have said to me for years, Brendan, you might go into politics, you might do this. You know, the water charges happened, the ESB dispute, Apollo House, whatever it happened to be, the IV, the tip theft. I've been involved in quite a lot. And some of it's been quite successful, and I'm a bit taking a lot of pride in it. But I always felt in the job that I was in, I could make a difference. And without going into any detail, I just won't go into any detail, I don't feel that for the last couple of years. And I'm here to make a difference. I'm here to try to contribute whatever it is I've got to have a better world. And I have values, and I've got a record, and I've got a voice. So for as long as I'm here, if I can use my record, and if I can use my voice, and if I can use what you refer to there as my bit of stubbornness or whatever it is, to affect a bit of change. And heaven knows we need change. There's a lot of anger out there. People are justifiably angry at a lot of things that are going on in the country, at the housing, at the cost of living crisis, at some of the things that are on our city. at the health service, aspects of the health service, not the cancer service, I have to say. Mm. And people are angry, and a lot of that anger is justified. And I think Europe, when I look to Europe, I see in Europe, and there's democratic deficits in Europe. It's a rich person's club, but nevertheless, across Europe, there are cities with genuine public housing. There are cities where you can get affordable, reasonably priced, even cheap childcare. There are single tier health systems free at the point of use. There are cities actually dealing with their drugs issues. There are cities that have eradicated homelessness. Mm. And Europe is never spoken about in that light in Dublin. We here in Dublin, we don't get told that. We just get told, you can't do this because of Europe. You can't do that because of Europe. Oh, that won't work. The European Union won't let you. It's a lie. It's all a lie. So, you know, I believe that the Dublin is a great city. It's a proud city. It's not cared in Europe. And I'm not going into any candidates who are running this time or any incumbents who are there now. I'm just stating as a fact, Dublin is not heard in Europe, and I want to make it heard in Europe. I'm stating as a fact that I believe some of the issues that affect your listeners and the people of Dublin have been answered and have been addressed. There is best practice out there. It's not all best practice, but we can find the best practice and we can bring that to Dublin. And look at, what are we going to do? Are we just going to give up? And are we just going to get angry? I said at the time of Apollo House when we were highlighting the homelessness in 2016, anger is not a policy.
Yes.
It's human. It's natural. So we all get angry, and sometimes that kind of feels good to get angry because we're hurt and we're expressing that hurt. But at the end of the day, it only damages ourselves.
Yeah.
It's not a policy.
But also,
we have to come together and find policies to work, Garrett. I'm trying to be fair and not, just not pick on anybody or any issue or any party. Just in general, that's my philosophy.
Yeah, but the problem now at the moment that we're facing and we're looking at it, it's like a brick wall of anger, and it's completely, it's almost eclipsing, it's almost overshadowing. You know, the whole immigration issue is chronic in this country. But that said, so is the housing issue. So is the cost of living. So is education. So are aspects of the health system. Like, for example, you touched on it there. They are. You touched on it a moment ago. You had to move to Athlone in order to be able to afford a house to live in.
1993.
And many people will say that. These are the people who say we don't have a voice. They will say, well, nothing has changed.
Well, it has got worse. It has changed. It's got worse. And the anger that people feel is justified. The gap between the haves and the have-nots. Like, in 1993, I was a young man starting out in a family life, hoping to have kids, and I have two beautiful girls now in their 20s. And I was able to buy a house, Garrett.
Yeah,
and I was able to afford the mortgage. My daughter is 26 now. She's the age now that I was then. She can't do that. She's at home living with her mum and at home. And so is my other younger daughter. She's only 21. But my 26-year-old, like 68% of young people between 25 and 29 in this country, are living with their parents. In Sweden, Denmark, and Finland, it's 5, 6, 7%. The European average is less than 20%. It's more than 20% less than ours. We are pulling up the European average. It's not the same everywhere. It's got much worse, Garrett. Anger is justified. But when I look around and see how much worse it's got, and I look at who is responsible for that, we've been ruled by the same two parties for 100 years.
Which are now
responsible.
Yeah, and many people say that they're now effectively the one party.
They are. Well, they were always the same, apart from the Civil War, anyway. And as the Civil War recedes into the realms of history, you know, so they're in coalition together for the first time. And, you know, if they get the numbers again in the next election, they'll do it again. So we've had a permanent conservative, I'm talking about economically conservative now, we've had a permanent conservative government in this country protecting the ruling class for 100 years. So who do you think is responsible for the problems?
Yeah.
How can it be somebody from Afghanistan or from Syria, because of a different colour face, or they speak a different language, or they've got a different culture? How can they be responsible for Irish problems that took 100 years to make? How can they be? So I'm clear where the problems lie. And that's not to say migration isn't an issue. We've got a broken immigration system. Completely broken. I think it's deliberately broken, by the way. I think it was deliberately broken 25 years ago when they set up a system that was far too slow. They didn't want to make decisions. They wanted to muck people around for 3 or 4 years so they wouldn't get a decision on whether their asylum applications qualified them for refugee status to put people off coming here. And they have never updated the system since.
Yeah.
Now we've got the war in Ukraine, 115,000 people coming in, a fascist war in Europe, fascist war zone from Moscow. And that has used up all of the spare accommodation that there is. And look, we're not talking about the home. When you listen to your show or any show, I'll give you a statistic there. 68% of young Irish people between 25 and 29 are living with their parents. That's a national scandal.
Yeah.
And it suits the government that we're talking about migration.
And
we should be talking about that statistic and who's responsible.
A poll in the Irish Times last week, nearly 60% of those polled say that this current government are only looking after the rich and powerful.
Well, look, it's Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Fine Gael were elected, were formed to protect the ruling class. The only thing that changed at that time on Dublin Castle was the flag. That's what they were formed to protect the landlord and the wealth class. Mm. Now, listen, that's not to say that the answer is to all go around and with pitchforks and take people's property of them. We need a decent society where we have a redistribution of wealth from the really, really rich and really, really rich corporations who don't pay tax, but also really, really rich people who don't want to pay tax. We need a redistribution to the rest, to the ordinary people, to my kids, to the kids listening to this show tonight, to the kids of the parents listening to this show tonight. And the only people that can do that are the people that we will elect in the 5, 10, 15, 20 years to come. Because if we keep electing the same parties, we're going to keep getting the same result. Mm. But let's push up. Let's do the hard thing. It's harder to push something up than it is to throw something down. So that's why people are kicking down at vulnerable people, because it's easier, it's reactive, it's instinctive, but it's harder to say, look at all that power up there, look at all that control, look at all that wealth, we have to change that. That's really hard. That takes real courage, it takes real vision. But that's what we need to do to change this country. That's what we need to do, and we can link arms, and we can come together and we can be bigger people and do that. We can do that. I believe that, Gareth. That's why I'm running.
Do you remember, it's probably less than 20 years ago, the British and Irish governments were talking about this compatible national identity card. I think Tony Blair, his Labour government, back in 2006, they legislated for this national identity card after years of debate. And they were going to share the whole thing between here and the UK, and they reckoned it was the only way you could overcome an immigration crisis. Is that the only way, do you think? Or what would your view be on the crisis we're in at the moment?
My view on the crisis at the moment, first of all, my view on the crisis is that it's primarily a housing crisis.
Yeah.
We've got, you know, 160,000, 170,000 empty properties. And the new properties that have been built, we've got vulture funds coming in, buying them up in dozens and hundreds. So what I would do, and of course one MEP doesn't get to do anything except make arguments and hopefully bring some awareness. There needs to be a massive public house building scheme. Like, I grew up in a council house. We need to get back into a situation where the state is building homes like they do across other parts of Europe. And then we need to get into a situation where, you know, there are punitive taxes on those empty properties. And then we need to have, and this happens in other countries, it happened in Canada, we need to have a moratorium on foreign investors buying Irish property until the Irish property emergency, the housing emergency, is over, until our kids get houses. Those three steps alone. Now, in terms of the migration, we need to have a rules-based system. We need to have a rules-based system that is quick, where we have turnaround of 3 to 6 months, where those who qualify for refugee status as a human rights issue or to stay here. But those who don't get to stay here.
Yeah.
But it needs to be quick. it needs to be turned around, and the people who are allowed to stay here need to be welcomed. I'll tell you something else we've got going on, Garrett. We've got a demographic emergency. We've got one of the most quickly aging populations in Europe. And I'm wondering, where are the workers going to be to pay the taxes and run the public services 10, 15, 20 years from now? And we don't have a funded national pension.
Yeah.
It's paid out of taxation.
Brendan,
we could be in trouble.
I'm going to have to leave it there, Brendan. It's been great talking to you, and I'm delighted the health is good and strong, and I wish you well in the weeks to come.
Thank you, Garrett. Good night to you.
Take care. Thanks, Brendan. That's Brendan O'Brien.
Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.